You're listening to Culture with Robert Bound, first broadcast on the 2nd of January on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 12th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's New Year, and for many of us, that means a new start. So this is a special edition of Culture dedicated to getting started in the creative industries. I'm joined in the studio by Claire Conville, the literary agent who uncovered DBC Pierre, who's brought us one of her authors with her, Damien Barr.
I am sitting here naked, but that's fine.
Also with us is Jack Tan, artist in residence at the General Social Care Council and a tutor on the sculpture programme of London's Royal College of Art.
I think teaching creativity is a really difficult thing because, I mean, what is creativity?
And New Year just doesn't mean new starts. It means new calendars too, of course. And there's none more famous than the Pirelli calendar. We'll be hearing from the CEO and the latest photographer, Mario Sorrenti, at their recent launch in New York City. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And welcome to the show. And thank God I'm not in the studio on my own. As promised, I'm here with Jack Tan, Claire Conville and Damien Barr. Thank you very much all for coming in so early in the new year.
You're welcome. Our hangovers have dissipated.
How are you all feeling? We're going to go around the table, Jack. What does 2012 sort of hold in store? Are you a New Year's resolution
man? New Year's resolutions. I think trying to get back into the studio and do some work. So it's really the teaching work balance, really, between making work and getting others to make work.
Okay. Yeah. And so. maybe you could fill our listeners in on what you're doing and what you're up to.
Well, what I'm up to at the moment is I teach sculpture at the Royal College of Art, and Royal College of Art is a wholly postgraduate college, so we've got about 60 sculpture students. And then on the other side, I am the artist in residence for the General Social Care Council, which is one of the councils that's in that, you know, bonfire of the quangos. So they are going to be closed down in, I think, July this year. So I'm there really as the artists really document their demise, really.
Okay. Well, that's not a bad thing for an artist to be
doing. No, it's good. It's very interesting.
Noble rot.
Yes, absolutely.
And Claire, maybe you could let our listeners, maybe you could introduce yourself also for our listeners. We talked at, in the introduction that you discovered DBC Pierre on the Victoria line. Obviously, you've added many more people to your stable right now, and you've also got a book out, or a reprint of your book out, called Dangerous Women at the moment.
Okay, yes, I'm a literary agent. I represent about 60, 70 writers, and ranging from people who write very serious literary fiction to quite commercial fiction. I'm also just published my first book, which I wrote with two other writers, Liz Hoggard and Sarah Jane Lovett, which is For Dangerous Women, A Guide to Modern Life. And my New Year's resolution is to see if I can get the next idea for a book off the ground, while at the same time looking after all my beloved authors.
One of whom is sitting across from you, Damien Barr.
Very beloved.
Hi, Damien. How's that sound? She's, you know, a lot of plate juggling, a lot of plate spinning for Claire in 2012.
Well, she manages to make every single one of her authors feel very special, I have to say. And I have to say, when she was doing the deal for my new book, we were speaking on the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning, the night before I was supposed to make a decision, in the very early hours of the morning. And she was handling sort of new bits and information, and she did it all with great style, and she managed not to scream at me. So she is very good.
All right. Well, we're going to, and also we need to let people know that you're not just a novelist, but you're a man that reads people bedtime stories to people in hotel rooms, and you have a salon and all the rest of it.
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, my whole life is kind of, it's all about stories, whether that's telling them or writing them or introducing other people to them.
Cool. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about New Year's resolutions and how to get started creatively after we've heard something great that will be presumably on our playlist on Monocle 24 in the new year. This is AM and Sean Lee, Someone Like You. That That was AM and Sean Lee, Someone Like You, from their new album out at the end of January called Celestial Electric. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're talking about getting started. I'm joined in the studio by literary agent Claire Conville and sculptor, tutor and artist Jack Tan from the Royal College of Art in London, and by the author Damien Barr. How easy is it to sort of, this is a sort of thing that comes up every single year, teaching creativity and getting kind of started. Is that, are you fostering talent and pushing it in a direction that you see it already flowing, or do you see yourself as very much a teacher, a strict teacher? Swapping the headphones for the mortarboard today, obviously.
I think teaching creativity is a really difficult thing, because, I mean, what is creativity? I mean, that's the thing, and who defines what it is? But I think really it's about kind of getting people to really say what they really mean, and kind of taking their life experience and their particular view on the world, and then to just say it kind of honestly and in as eloquently as possible. And I think we get in trouble when people try to say things in voices that aren't authentic or aren't their own.
Do you think that's a problem for, we were talking about getting started for first times, especially whether they're first time novelists, whether they're making their first record, or whether they're designed to study art or specialise in sculpture for the first time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acquired knowledge that bears itself out in people's work, I presume.
It is, and I think there's a problem with newness as well. So there's a kind of great desire to make the new, the big new thing that's going to kind of rock the world. But, I mean, there's truth in saying that there is nothing new, in a way. You know, everything's been repeated. But perhaps then, but there's something about being able to connect with that particular worldview that then just makes it new anyway, if you do it properly, if you do it kind of honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Claire, talking of newness, I mean, you're obviously reading manuscripts all the time, and you're also managing your catalogue of talent at the same time. Is newness always a preoccupation in the literary world as well, and in the publishing world, or are you looking for people to do a bit what they did last time and do it even better?
It's a very good question. The publishing world is totally preoccupied with newness. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes at the expense of developing and supporting talents in the long term, creative talents in the long term. I'm always looking for newness, but in terms of the authors I represent, I try and take on writers who are totally unlike any other writer I represent. So I hope that the people I represent are all doing something unique and all write in a very different way from one another. But yes, I don't think you can, continuing the conversation, I don't think you can teach creativity. It seems to me that it's totally there or it isn't. But I think it can be supported. I think it can be drawn out. But ultimately, it's the artist or the writer who finally defines it for themselves.
Talking of which, Damien, that's what we call a segue, I think. Well, as an author, you can tell us then about the, you know, the marshalling of your creative resources. Presumably, a lot about it is there's very creative people that never get anywhere, and presumably there is very much an idea of the work ethic, presumably for all three of you as well, and for the people that you interact with, teach, and the people that you're in charge of as such.
Yeah, I mean,
it's about getting up in the morning and doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, for a very long time, for nearly 10 years, I worked as a journalist, mostly at the Times and other places. And so I had deadlines drummed into me, and I'm proud to say that I never missed a deadline. And, you know, you can't have empty space in the paper, and you know, you certainly wouldn't want an editor breathing down your neck. So I've always had a very good work ethic. And I think that the difficulty you have when you move from doing something like that to a longer piece of writing or a bigger piece of writing is that that you don't have a deadline, because, you know, nobody's asking you for your memoir or your novel or your book of poems or short stories.
Is that particularly for debut novelists and for first books? I mean, or are,
I think it's
your agent and your publishing house?
I think if you have a track record, then of course you've got, you know, you know, because you can look at books that are, you know, there are books of yours on a shelf, and you look at that and you see, I've done it, I can perhaps do it again, other people want me to. But if you're trying to do it for the first time, I think that it's, you know, it's a great leap of faith. And, you know, particularly, I think when you're writing a memoir, you know, Diana Athill says, you know, she grew up and she was was told, you're not the only pebble on the beach. You know, there's a certain amount of self-privileging that goes on when you think, I'm telling a story, I have to believe my story is worth telling to somebody other than my therapist or my partner or, you know, or the taxi driver. So, you know, you've got to believe that your story's worth telling, and then you actually just have to sit down and do that. And I think for a lot of writers, that's the thing that's very hard. And Victor Hugo used to have his valet hide his clothes so that he would be naked, so that he couldn't go out and socialise with his friends. And then he got his clothes when he'd written the amount of words he had to write that day. I wouldn't take it quite that far. But Claire's looking at me like going, you've got a deadline next week. You've got a deadline.
Are you going to tell the good girls and boys that are tuning in what you're wearing today, Damien? Because you've obviously missed a deadline for the first time.
I am sitting here naked, but that's fine.
I've also we had to crank up the aircon this morning. I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we got there in time.
But I do think also, you know, you do have to get out of the way of yourself. I think once you connect with that authentic voice that Jack was talking about, and that's the thing that you've got to get to, because if you're just trying to write like, you know, DBC Pierre or somebody else, you're trying to imitate somebody, then that is very apparent. And you've got to connect with that voice and hone that voice that's your own voice. And then stay in touch with that. And that will be your voice. And you may not be telling, you may not be saying something that's new, a love story or whatever, but you're saying it in your voice and that makes it new.
I think the relationship between the work ethic and newness is what's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because there's something about how if you attend at the work, then, you know, a lot of not new stuff will get churned out. Mm. But then after a while, because so much of what's new comes through accident, improvisation, and it's almost that if you attend at it, something will come out, but a lot of the kind of not so great stuff comes out first before the water runs clear, really.
Yeah, I think you've got to be present in that process. And I think that's something that I learned from Claire's, is that, you know, you've got to persevere, and maybe in 10,000 words, there will be a fragment that enables you to go in a new direction or find that particular voice. And that's the thing that rings true. And I think that for me is what it's about, is distilling it down, you know, getting the crap out of the way, you know. Is it Graham Greene? I can't remember who it was that said about murdering your darlings. You know, you spend ages making something beautiful, and actually you're making it for yourself, you know, or you're indulging something.
Yeah, I'm also quite keen on the idea of being unabashed about showing not so great stuff as well. Because, I mean, like, I am a keen lover of the Romantic poets. Mm-hmm. So Shelley, for example, I love Shelley, but I do think two-thirds of it is a bit crap, really. But you don't remember him for the crap stuff.
Yeah. No.
You know, you just think, wow, he's written these great things. And I think it's all right to kind of put, you know, stuff that's not so great out.
Before we do that, we're going to have to take a break for a song, and we'll come back to how to get started, and about the dangers perhaps of being prolific as well. This is New from Bosco Del Rey. That was Baby's Got a Blue Flame, New from Bosco Del Rey. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. We're talking about getting started. We'll be back in a second.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much about other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, where we're talking about getting started. I'm joined by Jack Tan, sculptor tutor at the RCA in London, Claire Conville, literary agent and author, and Damien Barr. Maybe I could ask, we'll maybe go around the table and ask specifically how everybody got started and what they're doing now. Jack, to be a sculptor tutor, presumably you were a sculptor. How did it kick off for you? Because I want people to listen to this and know and get an inkling of how people got their break to be where they are.
No, I didn't start in sculpture. I started as a lawyer.
Right.
And I simply just needed to get out of the office and go and do pottery evening classes. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I did it for 6 months, it was 3 hours a week, you know, doing pottery evening classes. Then at some point, a thought occurred to me that I'd rather do 3 hours of law a week and then the rest of my time doing playing with clay. And one thing led to another. I left my job and went and retrained, really.
And Claire, maybe you can tell us, how it kicked off for you. That moment when you know that what you're doing is fun, but you have suddenly have an air of responsibility and that it's all going well.
Well, I suppose I became a literary agent because I lost my job as a publisher, and so I just asked someone to give me a job, and much to my amazement, they did. But I think the tipping point was when I started my own company with my business partner, Patrick Walsh, and we really had to take responsibility for our lives and for the authors we were, you know, representing, and for the people who began to work with us as part of the team. And I do believe in this, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has this 10,000 hours theory, and I do believe in that. I think I've reached a stage of my life where I've done enough. I've worked for a long time as an agent, and I feel I instinctively kind of know what to do without being arrogant about it. I feel very comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And that's great because I think it instills confidence in the authors I represent.
And Damien, you went from being a journalist to a novelist and author. How did that? I know you were talking about your good, solid work ethic there. Mm. But I mean, is that how it came down to it? Phoning up agents, phoning up publishers in order to get what you had published, or was your name a little bit of a sort of a key to that as well?
I think it's helpful. I mean, any agent, it's helpful for agents and publishers if you have some kind of profile in whatever it is that you do, whether that's journalism or whether it's, you know, cheese making or ceramics or whatever it is that you do. I enjoyed journalism. I still do write features and I still do enjoy it, but I wanted to, you know, it's the dragon that chases its own tail, and I wanted to have contact with a bigger story and a wider context and not necessarily be bound by a very strict word limit or a very strict kind of remit. And so I found myself being frustrated with the conventions of journalism. At the same time, you know, I also wanted to get more people more engaged and more excited in books. I would go to a lot of literary events and find them quite dry or quite worthy, often quite excluding. And that's why I started Shoreditch House Literary Salon, because I felt there are a lot of people who are excluded by the kind of literary establishment and who loved books and who loved stories and who also wanted to find out about the authors. So alongside my own writing, I am also running events which are about writing and about writers, and the two kind of feed off each other really well.
And presumably for your creative brain as well, that's great. It's balm to your creativity to be surrounded by ideas. And talking about ideas is something that we're becoming less scared to do, I think. These salons that we made a package at the Idler Academy this week, and Tom Hodgkinson is that similar sort of character, I suppose, putting on these evenings. The reinvention of the salon seems to be something that wouldn't be bad to buy shares in perhaps for 2012.
Well, I think with the recession and people sort of, you know, they maybe have less money and therefore more time in some senses, and they want to engage with bigger ideas, and they see that the world is changing, and they want to engage with those ideas, and there's no shame in wanting to be smart about it. At the same time, you know, you can read Heat magazine and you can also read Granta. You know, you can be a cultural omnivore, and I think that's a growing niche. And these live literary events, some of them with music and some of them very specific, cater to that. You know, it's cool to sit and talk about ideas.
Yeah, I also think it's a way of, as increasingly people buy books from Amazon off the internet, it's a way of connecting again with the author and the writer, and feeling connected to the creative spirit, really. I mean, there's nothing as fresh or as interesting as hearing it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah. I mean, Maggie O'Farrell at the last Salon was reading, you know, draft of her new novel as a work in progress, and she's never shared that with anybody, hadn't shared it with her husband. And lots of authors, you know, have come along and done things like that because it's an atmosphere of trust and it's also a community, and they think, these are my readers, you know, and you have a responsibility to them.
All right, we're going to take a little break for a package. This is something that Jack knows all about. We are joined by artist in residence at the General Social Care Council, Jack Tan, and a tutor on the sculpture programme of London's Royal College of Art, who held an exhibition of first and second year MA students, ceramic and glassware. And we sent our reporter, Amanda Brown, down to check it out.
We're in the kiln room. So there are a dozen kilns here, all firing work by different students.
Shelley James is a PhD student studying and working with glass at the Royal College of Art. She's passionate about what she does.
I love the chance to pursue ideas and to work with some extraordinary technicians and tutors to really get to grips with some of the questions that we're asking, and not only do that in an intellectual way, but also do that through the materials. So it's the conversation between making and thinking that's so very exciting about what I'm doing at the moment.
What would you advise someone who wants to get into this area to do, first of all?
What's always worked for me is to do what I love doing as well as I can and as much as I can. When I've made work that I'm less proud of and that hasn't actually worked commercially or creatively is when I've tried to fit into some idea of what might be expected. So I think being passionate and working hard are the two things that I can recommend.
And specifically going into glass work, are there courses or are there sort of placements that you might be able to do if you were keen on learning about it?
Lots of universities are much keener on you sitting behind a computer than heating up a load of glass and dropping it on the floor. So there are still some extraordinary places where you can go. Farnham, obviously, at the University of Creative Arts in Farnham. There is still a course, I believe, in Wolverhampton. There are lots of fantastic evening classes as well, so that's another way of finding out if it's what you really love to do.
The Royal College of Art is currently exhibiting ceramics and glassworks by Year 1 and 2 MA students.
I'm Jane Hunt, and I'm studying an MA, so I'm in my second year, and I specialise in glass. Satisfaction at the end of the day is really important. The fact that actually you've making something is important rather than just, I mean, I used to work in an office, and moving paper around from one side of the desk to the other really didn't do it for me. So this actually making something is very important, and actually using my hands to physically make something rather than, because I mean, a lot of people use computers and digitally rapid process or that sort of thing, but that's not what I'm interested in at all.
My name is Nam Tran, and the pieces I've done are ceramic marble pieces with glass attached handles to them. And the way I've approached this process is that I'm really technique orientated, so I focus a lot on how the material quality of my pieces affect the final outcome.
I'm Tamsin Van Essen, work at the Royal College of Art. I'm studying ceramics, MA. I'm working on, I'm looking at a vase form, but I'm not doing functional ware. I'm looking at two things. One is looking at the material, the way materials work. So taking incompatible clays that shouldn't work together. Popular ceramic wisdom say these clays are completely incompatible. I'm trying to combine them together in this vase form, which is starting to disintegrate but still holding its shape in a recognisable way.
My name is Simone Perrot. I'm a ceramicist. I've been working several years in Paris in my own studio. So I needed a change and I came here for that. I think for me, meeting people was the best way to be introduced in ceramics. Professionals, maybe students, to visiting schools, visiting studios, have lots of chats and informations. I think it's the best way to be sure of what you want to do. Then use your hands and start doing things, making.
The beauty of the ceramics and glasswork on display at the RCA belies the amount of sweat and effort that goes into creating them.
The core driving force is the passion and commitment of artists and the designers to the creative process.
And that was Amanda Brown checking out a show of first and second year MA Ceramic Art. Jack, there were people in there glorying in making their mistakes as well. Mm. How important is it when you're teaching people to sort of encourage them to do lots of stuff? Some of it's brilliant, some of it's not. You can treat those imposters both the same sort of thing. It's important for people to make mistakes when they're starting, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's not just when you're starting, but every time you make work, it's a start. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always starting. And the reason why it's important to make mistakes is because I think what you enter into is a space of improvisation, basically, because that's where the work comes out of. The work should surprise you.
Surprise yourself, as you.
Yes, yeah, as the, yeah. The person making the work should surprise you, and the only way that it can surprise you is if you improvise. You just let it go.
And I mean, obviously, Jack's a tutor at the RCA for postgraduate students, and he went to an evening class himself in order to kick off with pottery in the first place after being a lawyer. When you're looking at when people are writing letters to you, writing emails to you, trying to get on your books, are there things you look out for in terms of which particular courses people have done? I mean, there's any really the most famous course in the UK is, I guess, the creative writing course at East Anglia University. But how easy is it to, I mean, do you look out for any other courses, or do you, you know, treat everything just the same?
Well, we get 12,000 manuscripts a year now at Convolent Walsh, which is my company, which is a huge amount. So, we have now a team of people who go through that material, and then it's then probably about 30 manuscripts a month are kicked upstairs, and then we share them and we talk about them and make decisions about them. I mean, I have to say I don't believe there are a million people in this country with sort of brilliant works, brilliant novels lying, you know, are misunderstood in their bottom drawers. I think most good work gets through, at least to a second stage. What do I look for? A simple letter. Yes, I think being on a good creative writing course helps, but actually they can sometimes, I think, be as damaging as they can be supportive. Certainly in America, I get manuscripts that come my way from American authors, and, you know, you read three pages and you just think the dead hand of the creative writing school. I mean, it's right. Absolutely, you can spot it in one. So I look for real, I don't look for perfection at all. I look for freshness and a voice and originality and something that kind of connects to me. And like all agents, I've probably missed some very good novels along the way, but I think most of the time another reasonably good agent has picked them up, you know, so it's you can't love everything.
No, indeed. And Damien, I mean, when there's 12,000 manuscripts going through a literary agent's office every year, how on earth do you decide that first line of that first paragraph of that first novel?
I feel like I've just won the lottery and I didn't realise it. No, I think different agents deal differently. I mean, I did have an agent. I was represented by someone else before mm-hmm. I was with Claire, and I think Claire does work incredibly closely on your manuscript, and she works with you line by line sometimes, and you kind of fight it out. But and other agents won't do that. So I think if people are thinking about getting started, they need to approach the right kind of agent, the right person for them. So there's no point if you write science fiction and approaching a children's list or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be going for people who are like you, but you don't want to be trying to be the same as those people. I think that's the really important point. You asked me another question. What was it? Oh, to do with creative writing.
Yes.
The first, how do you decide? Yeah. I did actually have a first line in my head for ages about what I wanted the first line of my book to be, and I realised that first line was rubbish, and really what it was a reminder in my head to go back and write the book. It was a sort of note to self, actually, mm-hmm. rather than an opening sentence, and I won't be using it in my book. But a lot of what I
just had it, unfortunately, had it tattooed on your forearm.
I know, that was a bit of a mistake. But I do know that when I sent a bunch of work to Claire, you know, she did come back and say, "I love this. It's not perfect. Where do you see it going?" And I think that has to be part of the creative process, is that you trust people, you trust, you know, your tutor or your agent to have a view and to have done, you know, their 10,000 hours or whatever it is, and to be able to put you in a context and guide you. But ultimately, it's not about them, it's about you, mm-hmm. you know, and it's your piece of art, it's your song, it's your book, And you have to be able to live with yourself as the creator of that. I think all too often, particularly, you know, with Facebook and Twitter, people externalize that process and they seek validation from the group. You know, it's an external locus of evaluation. And it might be great if lots of other people like it, but actually that's it may not be the thing that you're supposed to do or that you're trying to do, and you lose sight of that. So It is important to share your work with people and to be able to take criticism, but you shouldn't be doing your work for them.
Well, I wanted to go around the table quickly before we go and ask you for one piece of advice, not necessarily for 2012, but if anyone wanted to start off as a sculptor, a ceramicist, as an artist or as a writer, we talked about the 10,000 Malcolm hours, 10,000 hours, which I think mean that no one's really a genius. It's all about hard work, isn't it, really? Like the Beatles did 10,000 hours of live sort of recording live performance before they ever hit a note on a record. But Claire, maybe you could...
I think it's not... The 10,000 hours is for sort of mere mortals like myself, where you just have to... You do your time and then you become reasonably good at what you do. I think it's very different for artists. I think often artists, I mean, certainly novelists, often produce their very best work when they're very young. I mean, it can vary enormously. And it's known that some writers, some artists, somehow run out of steam. And it's not that they've stopped being brilliant, but somehow that creative expression has lost its way or has dwindled. I mean, it can vary enormously.
But then you look at Diana,
who's come into her own
in her 80s.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So. But I mean, the one piece of advice I'd give to an aspiring writer is write something every day. And the simplest way to do that is keep a diary, just to start with. I mean, that because it's kind of got a structure and it's got a page and you've got something to write about. But if you want to be a writer, write something at least once a day.
Damien, what can you...
I would say delete something at least once a day as well. I think that's the really important part. For me, it's all about... I always want to get to the, don't use a dollar word where a 10-cent word will do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, try and... I like to try and strip back sentences in my writing to them being as sort of as functional as possible. Maybe that's journalistic training, but, you know, and I probably do it too much, actually.
This was the idea. This is what that amazing beginning, you know, Raymond Carver's beginnings taught us. The relationship with your editor is an incredibly intimate and incredibly creative one, presumably, as well.
Yeah.
Being able to delete a lot of stuff.
I think you have to be able to do that. And I think that, you know, Claire did very well selling my book Maggie and Me. Lots of people wanted it, and I had to go and talk to lots of people, and I wasn't prepared to make choices. And in the end, you know, I didn't make a choice based on money. I made a choice based on the person that I thought I would be able to take bad news from the best. And I think that is probably a really honest assessment. I think, you know, I think that's what you need to be able to deal with.
Damien, thanks for your brutal words of advice. They sound very true. True to the bone. Jack, you've had enough time now to conjure up something.
Well, I think I'm interested in culture. I mean that's the perspective. And I think, yes, we make products along the way, but I think we all make culture, and that's what we're trying to do, really, because culture is what enriches the social fabric. And I think really it is, my advice is really show us what you see. I mean, it's as simple as that. Show
Perfect.
Us what you see. See, recognise what you see, and then show us what you see.
Show us what you see. Jack Tan, sculptor tutor at the RCA, Claire Conville, literary agent, and Damien Barr, author. Thank you all very much for joining us for our New Year special of culture here on Monocle 24. And we're going to cut to a song. This is new from the Big Pink. Hits the Ground. That was the Big Pink with Hit the Ground's Superman from their upcoming record, Future This. You're listening to New Year Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're talking about getting started.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
So The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing. We are shining a spotlight on the people around the world who are driving innovation within their industry.
I didn't set out to become a perfumer, so it's almost an accident, which doesn't sound very business-like, but it is.
So it's not about bulls and bears, it's about small businesses, it's about the businesses you've always dreamed to set up, it's about the entrepreneurs who are daring to go out there and do it.
That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to New Year Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, a new year means you need a new calendar. Your office probably gave you one last month as a subtle gift to say, be more organised. And the most famous of them all is the Pirelli calendar, the posh version of every tyre repair garage's soft porn wall decoration. This year, Mario Sorrenti, the world-renowned fashion snapper, shot the calendar for the Italian tyre maker and was keen to point out that it's all about celebrating the nude and channeling the Renaissance rather than just looking at naked ladies. That is why it's in the culture show, of course.
Over the years, obviously, the Pirelli calendar has produced some really beautiful and iconic images. How familiar were you with the calendar before you were selected?
I knew it very well. I have several books of their calendars and also some out-of-print books that they had done in the past, and I knew of it. I've actually never seen a calendar myself, but I knew of it, yes.
And how did you find out that you'd been selected to shoot this year's calendar?
They contacted me, Pirelli contacted me, and they said that they were interested in looking at my work and knowing what kind of ideas would I have, if they would want me to do the calendar. And so we started a conversation, and then they came to my studio, and we talked, and we met. And
of all the locations, how did you choose Corsica?
It was really a process of elimination. It was about finding the place that had the correct geology, the rock formations, the trees, the beach, all of these things very close to each other so that I had no time to waste going from one set to the next. And, it was warm enough so that the girls wouldn't be cold. It was in not too far away so that it wasn't really a problem for people to fly to. So there were a lot of, logistical things that had to be considered.
And what were the major differences between doing a shoot in a place like rural Corsica versus shooting in a studio? What were some of the challenges that you dealt with in that?
The unpredictability of the light, of the weather. I mean, I was very, very lucky that it was beautiful. Every day was gorgeous, I was very fortunate with that. But you get things happen that you can't recreate in a studio, so it was really a plus to be out in nature, and it was what I wanted for the photographs anyway.
And how would you describe this year's body of work?
I'd like to describe it as somehow we tried to achieve some sort of a portrait, maybe, of some sort of inner beauty within the girls.
And over the past nearly 50 years, it turns out you're the first Italian to do the shoot for an Italian company, Pirelli. What did it mean to you to be selected?
I mean, for me personally, it was a great honor to be selected for Pirelli because it's a really prestigious event. It's a prestigious calendar. It's an honor to be included in the stable of photographers that have done this. As an Italian, of course, it's as well really exciting that I could be somehow representing the Italians or Italy, but it's not something that really I'm focused on, to be honest with you. But, I'm sure that all my family in Italy would be very proud of me.
I'm the chairman and CEO of Pirelli.
And how did the idea of a calendar come to be for Pirelli?
The idea coming in the 60s from the UK, Pirelli UK. So they made the calendar just for customers. And then the product was very good, and so we started this story that is a success story until now.
And how does the Pirelli calendar sort of represent the Pirelli brand? How is the spirit of your company exemplified in this?
I think it represents glamour and passion. So the two qualities that are part of our history, of our people way to approach business. So that is Pirelli calendar.
And Pirelli, if I understand correctly, is operating in about 160 global markets right now. And just looking at the models that you've used for this shoot, it looks like you've gotten a very global group of individuals to model for it. How important is it that Pirelli has as many global models as you've gotten?
Because we are global. I mean, we are from China to Brazil, producing and delivering our technologies. And so we are known everywhere, and we try to get the best.
And how is this project different from other commercial shoots that some might compare to the Pirelli calendar?
I don't know why, but we put a lot of passion in what we do, and the result is fine. So I don't want to compare it to anybody. So I just want us to do our best.
From New York City, that was Mario Sorrenti and Marco Tronchetti Provera, chairman and CEO of Pirelli. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So that's about all we have time for this week. Weren't we honoured and lucky to have in the studio Jack Tan, sculptor tutor at the RCA, Claire Conville, literary agent, and the author Damien Barr. Next week we'll be focusing on storytelling, and some of our usual goodies will return. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. Time for one final song this week, Emmylou by First Aid Kit. This is from their new upcoming album, The Swedish Sisters, rocking out or countrying it out as ever. Happy New Year. Oh,